throw over here, so.
They are, there's a huge difference.
Yeah, that's me, huh? Excellent. We're just going to wait for a couple of minutes to get things started. Yeah, that's somebody put on this.
Yes.
And we'll be able to start with a little guided meditation for everyone to calm down. And we'll. Can't hear.
You need a mic.
Okay. So we're going to start in a few minutes. Can people hear now?
Yes.
Okay. Now you're messing around. So I'm going to start in a few minutes with a meditation to relax to the max. I'm not quite sure how far you've come. We just came in from Devon just on the train just a few minutes ago. Gives me a chance also to relax to the max. Those people who are there in Devon with me, I told a little story of this gentleman. This is just warming people up before we really start. Who went to the psychologist and told him, sometimes I feel like I am a marquee. At other times, I'm sure I'm a teepee, like a wigwam. And the doctor said, that's a very common problem in London today. You are too tense. Okay, that went okay.
get worse.
I can get worse. Here's a worse joke. There were these two carrots walking along Baker Street. The audio, I haven't come to the punchline yet. And they're walking along Baker Street, and there's one person lost control of their car and hit one of the carrots. Very badly injured, his friend dialed 999. An ambulance came within a few minutes, took one look at the injured carrot, immediately in the back of the ambulance, with sirens howling, to the emergency department of the local hospital. This friend, Mr. Carrot, in the back, really worried, looked like a very serious injury. When they got to the hospital, straight into the emergency department, the triage nurses said, this is really serious, this is on the edge of life and death. So they took the injured carrot into emergency surgery, and his friend, the other Mr. Carrot, was in the waiting room, just so afraid what's going to happen to his best friend. And after 2 hours, the surgeon came into the waiting room and said to this carrot, said, you must be the friend of the injured carrot. How did you know? I have got some good news and bad news for you. The good news is, because we managed to get to his injuries really soon, he's going to survive. He's going to pull through. But because of his injuries, he'll be a vegetable for the rest of his life. It does not get worse than that. Okay, I think most people are in, so we can start with a little bit of meditation, if that's all right for everybody, for about 20 minutes. Yeah. Okay. So, first of all, water. So, here we go. So, sitting comfortably in your seats. You don't need to move your back forward, because ask any physiotherapist, the most comfortable posture is where the backrest is 15 degrees from the vertical, just like you have there. And it also means if you're leaning back a little bit, even if you fall asleep, you don't fall off the chair, because, you know, you're always leaning backwards, so you fall a bit further backwards. It's one of those things when people are meditating and they have a straight back, if they fall off and injure themselves, they may sue the organisation, especially me. I don't worry that much because I'm leaving the country in a couple of days. But nevertheless, the organisation here may be in trouble. So, because we're tired. We've been working hard, rushing around. So, close your eyes. Sorry? You want to say one thing? You already said it. That's two things.
This is the third thing. People are maybe still coming, so just because there's very few seats, if people at the edge of the aisle could move in, so that because now you've started meditation, they'll have to climb over you. So that would be really helpful. Then they can find a seat. Thank you very much.
Very good. That's very kind. I know that people like to be on the end seats, so if I tell a really bad joke, you can get out without climbing over anybody. Okay. Excellent. So now, you can close your eyes. When your eyes are closed, please bring your attention to your body sitting here. To calm it down. And to be able to calm the body down, especially to bring awareness or what we call mindfulness onto your own body, a very helpful means is to ask a question of each part of your body. As if your body was made up of individual beings. So you can start off with your legs and say, legs, how are you? How do you feel right now? Do you need adjusting? If you're sitting on a chair, sometimes you need to push your feet forward, sometimes to draw them in again, sometimes to spread the legs. Find the best position for your legs on this chair. It's called mindfulness together with kindness. The kindness takes those extra steps to make the most comfortable position for your legs. And then you move up to your butt to see if you can fidget now. Instead of later. Aware of any feelings in your butt and adjusting your butt. And moving up to your back, asking your back, how are you? Do you need to be stretched? Or leaning forward or leaning back? Usually leaning back is the best. And then to your shoulders. How are your shoulders now? Sometimes the shoulders are like a group of strings being pulled apart on either side of your spine. And you imagine letting go of any tension, any pulling or pushing or squashing or stretching. Let your shoulders relax. To the max. Then look at your arms and hands. It doesn't matter exactly where they are, but just ask, are you comfortable there? Really be aware and take what your body tells you with a sense of importance. Sometimes we think we know better than what our body continually tells us. So I listen to my body. If it's tired, I rest it. If it's tense, I relax it. Then go up from your hands up to your neck. How does your neck feel now? Many people have little coughs. Sometimes those coughs, which we sometimes contact because We rush around and become a little tired. Sometimes it's like these viruses going around. Bird flu or other flus. This particular one going around London right now, there it is called polyvirus. I know it's polyvirus because it makes me a little hoarse. A couple of people listening. So if you have an irritation in your throat, just be aware of it and see how you can relax your throat. Be kind to it. When I was growing up in West London, in Acton, every time I would play soccer on the streets, when I would go for a tackle and fall on the ground, it wasn't grass, it was either bitumen of the road or the stones of the pavement. And I scraped the skin off my knees. My mother would come running up, crouch down and kiss it better. She'd apply an open mouth full of germs onto this open wound. But it would never ever get infected. And the pain would go away immediately, just with a little bit of kindness. And from that time on, I know that if you haven't got a mother to kiss the pain, you can do it yourself. I'm aware of any irritation in my body, especially just irritation in the throat. And I'm kind to it, compassionate, as gentle as a mother to her little child. And I feel relaxation happen. I find that the muscles around the throat relax. With anger or fear, things get tight. They get tense. With kindness, there's a sense of safety that everything will be okay. So the irritation lessens. My muscles don't overreact. And I feel so much more at ease. So I can give the talk. When I move up to my face, sometimes the muscles around the eyes and the mouth get screwed up. Out of fear, tension, anger. When I look at those muscles, I can feel the muscles around my eyes. I learn how to relax them. The muscles around my mouth, I relax those too. By relaxing, I take away the tension. Sometimes I imagine a guitar string or a violin string pulled apart, stretched by pulling it at both ends. I know when it's pulled tight and something hits it, a petrol or something, it makes a bing, a high-pitched sound. If I loosen the tension, when something hits it, it makes a dull sound. Boom. When there's no tension at all, and something hits it, it doesn't make any sound at all. This is my simile for resilience. If you're very tired, and the virus, pain, the disappointment, hits you, you really feel it. But when you're so relaxed, you tend not to make any reaction at all. It's like a guitar string which is loose. Things hit it, and there's no reply. It's called resilience. All coming from knowing how to sit peacefully and relax to the max. Sometimes that I imagine my brain a couple of inches behind my eyes, but in my ears, working so hard. When it's meditation time, I imagine taking my brain out of my head, only imagination, and tucking it in to a little basket, putting a duvet over it, and sending it to sleep for 20 minutes. It deserves to have some peace. It doesn't deserve to worry, to be afraid. This is a time for peace. Peace of mind. To rest in peace. R.I.P. When you're still alive to enjoy it. And I notice my whole body sitting here in an armchair in Rudolf Steiner House. Really relaxing. And I feel the delight of relaxation. There's a pleasure in my body which I've got to associate with my body at ease. I imagine it's similar if you've been lying on a recliner on some beautiful beach in Bali or somewhere with nothing to do with the body fully relaxed, or being in a spa, had a massage. There's no tension to be found anywhere in your body. And you do that just by meditating. And there's a certain pleasure I feel, the delight of relaxation. I focus on that, I'm aware of that, because when I'm aware of the delight of a relaxed body, my body gets deeper into stillness and ease, when nothing is being stretched or squashed or held tight. Body at peace. Healing. Re-energizing. That feeling of delight in my body. It's a very attractive feeling, and it keeps me in the present moment. It gives a bridge to what's going to happen next, into learning how to relax the mind. And I imagine that I've been carrying two heavy bags on these journeys around England or around Europe, around the world. Or like two heavy shopping bags. And I look at the shopping bag in my left hand and it has a name letters on the outside. Not Harrods or Marks and Spencers or anything. It has the letters P-A-S-T. Past. Because in that bag in my left hand I've stuffed all my memories, both bad and good. All that stuff which I carry around from the past is in that bag in my left hand. And I've been carrying it for such a long time that my arm is tired, my shoulder hurts. And then I look, imaginary bag in the right hand. That has different letters on the outside of the bag. F-U-T-U-R-E, the future. Because in that bag, it's filled to the brim with all my fears, anxieties, hopes and dreams, which I too carry around so long. So even when I sleep, I carry that bag. Which means my right arm also is tired. My right shoulder aches. The past and the future which we carry around with us. And then, imagining that bag in my left hand, representing my past. I imagine, visualize leaning to my left, so I can lower the bag in my left hand, containing my past, to the ground, when it meets the floor, all the weight disappears. It's no more burden. I'm still grasping the handle. I imagine opening the fingers of my hand, moving my hand away from the handle of that bag containing my pass, straightening my back so my left arm is hanging loosely by my side, relaxing, rejuvenating, re-energizing, sorry. So my left arm has let go of my past. I can always pick it back up again afterwards if I need to. I don't need to be afraid of losing something. But for now, I've let it go. And then I imagine the bag in my right arm, my right hand, the future, all those fears and plans and anxieties. I imagine leaning to the right, allowing me to lower the bag in my right hand, representing the future, to the floor. And again, as it meets the ground, the burden is released. It's not heavy anymore, but the ground is holding it. And then I move my arm away from the handle, my right hand and arm, move it up to my side, so that too can re-energize, recuperate. Even my shoulder can recuperate. And then I look down. I put those two bags, the past and the future, on either side. And I'm standing in this wonderful place, right between the past and the future, what we call the present moment. I don't need to be afraid that someone is going to take those bags away. They're going to be there for me afterwards when the meditation is finished. But I've learned how to put them down. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, however much time you have, to relax, to re-energize, to rest. To be in this moment, because I deserve this time of peace. So when the meditation is over, I can pick up those bags and carry them easily, because my muscles have rested. This is one of the methods which I use, the visualization to come into the present moment. One thing to say, let go of the past, let go of the future. And having a little mental exercise to do helps you come to this place of presence and realize just how relaxing and free it is when you let go of the past. You're not running after the future. You're relaxing as you deserve to. In this present moment, I try to listen, experience this moment, rather than giving my opinion about it. It's like you're listening and feeling the world, not talking back at it with thoughts and ideas. You're developing silence. Just listen. Silence. You feel what it's like when you don't give anything a name. You don't need to take a note inside of your mind of what this means. You let it be in silence, in the quietness of this moment. Just be aware, feeling, listening, not planning, not arguing, just listening. Today, the calm is deeper. When we go in a car, we have a speedometer. When we look at the temperature, we have a thermometer. Now I ask you to imagine your peace-o-meter. How peaceful is your mind now? Giving it a number from 1 to 10. 1 is really, really calm. 10 is being agitated. From number 1 to 10. How would you describe your mind right now? Your emotions, your inner self. How peaceful are you from 1 to 10? And once you are mindful of your peaceometer, what makes that reading, that measurement, fall closer to 1? And what raises that peaceometer reading, making you more agitated? This is where we learn, by looking at the peaceometer, how to calm our mind down, how to bring peace to ourselves. And we also start to realize what peace feels like. It's not a word, it's an experience. Peace of mind. Deeper and deeper. Peace upon peace upon peace. As the reading of the peaceometer goes lower and lower and lower. How does it feel to be peaceful? When you realize the delight of a peaceful mind, you'll incline towards it more and more and more. The mind needs this peace, especially in today's world. So busy, doing so much, we do lose our physical and emotional resilience. We react far too quickly and aggressively, even violently. We need to know what peace is. We need to know our peaceometer. And to know how to keep it close to the wrong readings. To know the art of relaxation is also the art of happiness. Peace. So I'm going to be quiet for about 1 minute to allow you to enjoy where you have arrived. And then I'll bring you out of meditation to finish this short period. your attention on your breathing. Breathing in, count 3 breaths. Breathing in, breathing out. Breathing in, breathing out. Breathing in, breathing out. The third breath, open the eyes to end the meditation. Reminded because I was just coming back from Devon this afternoon that in 1973-74 I spent a year as a school teacher in one of the high schools in Devon, and this is the old days when you usually start the day with an assembly, and the principal of that school just wanted every teacher, including the new ones like me, to take the assembly 5 mornings and doing whatever I liked. And so I warned him that I was a Buddhist even then, and I liked meditation. And so he invited me to go and teach meditation to 650 school kids, both genders, from 11 years of age to maybe 17 years of age. And I remember the occasion, going up on the stage and seeing 650 kids sitting in front on the floor as I said, I'm going to now teach you how to meditate, and ask them all to cross their legs, which they did, to close their eyes, which they did, to straighten their backs, and I remember just the wave of backs straightening up in the hall, and to start, in this particular case, watching their breath, but just for 5 minutes. And every kid did that. It was only afterwards that one of the teachers told me, he said, what would you have done if one of the children started giggling? Only then did I break out into a sweat. Because you know what would have happened if one kid had started giggling? That would have broken the spell and everyone would have been disturbed. But they all complied and had 5 minutes of meditation. And to my surprise and also delight, without being asked, when they ended that meditation, every one of those kids started clapping and gave me an ovation. Somehow or other they felt something very important, some peace, at the beginning of their school day. After being running around in the playground, getting into the class, having their names taken, whatever it was, and coming to assembly, starting the day with 5 minutes of peace was amazing. And they knew it, they felt it without being told. They clapped. And for that year I was at that school, never ever saw anyone else getting a clap like that. There's something about these teachings of peace which actually grab a person. They know it's something really important and peaceful. And it also starts to open up so many avenues of wisdom. Things which work. And today, the title of the talk, the subject of the talk, is like words which hurt and words which heal, or something like that. Just the power, not just of words, but the power of even the thoughts and where those words come from. And I'm going to start, just because I'm in this mood of that being really peaceful and calm, of asking you to close your eyes again. Don't even change your posture. As I say the word, calm. 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 You can open your eyes now, but when you say a word, you start actually feeling calm. The mind begins to know this. And so the word has the power to direct the mind, consciously or subconsciously, to where it wants you to look. And that becomes a really interesting way of communicating with yourself or with others. The words of speech does have power. And sometimes that when you say even things like calm or peace or love or whatever, it means that you get yourself and others to look at places inside your mind which you probably never explored before, which actually exist in there. Sometimes that people, when they grow up, there's even one of have wonderful stories about looking deeply inside a person and getting them to look at the same place which I'm looking at, to realize that there's more to them than they ever expected. There was one monk I was talking about earlier that he was told by his grandfather when he was young, he did something bad at school, one of the exams he didn't really get, and his grandfather just took him aside and called him stupid and said, "You're hopeless, you're really dumb, you never do well at school." And because of that he never tried anymore at school. And instead he became a very funny monk with me. He's always got a very good sense of humour and makes everybody laugh. And once he became a monk, everything he did to such a high standard. And now he became a professional cook. So we were really, when he was just in the monastery helping out, it was really, really an act of letting go to ordain him as a monk so he wouldn't be a cook anymore. His cooking was delicious. But then he did other acts in our monastery, other jobs. Whatever he did was perfect. He was highly intelligent, but just that one word from someone he trusted when he was young just changed his whole life. He was told he was stupid by someone he looked up to and trusted, and so he became stupid. And this actually brings me up to one thing which I learned as a school teacher. One had to learn some psychology, and one experiment which changed a lot of how I look at other people and myself was the experiment done here in the UK in the time when we had streaming. You know, we had the different grades of school, you know, grade 1, 2, 3, or class 1, 2, 3, up into the first form, second form, third form, fourth form, sixth form, or whatever. And in this particular case, it was something like the third year at high school. It was important, but not crucial like the O-level years or the A-level years. And there were two classes of 30 children. And after they gave the end of the year examinations, they decided not to publish the results, instead to split the classes up, or split the children up evenly. So one child, the one who came top, went in one class, together with the child who came fourth and fifth, eighth and ninth, 12th and 13th, 16th and 17th. And the children who came second and third, second and third, sixth and seventh, 10th and 11th, went in the other class. It was just a method to try and split the classes up evenly. And the principal and the two psychologists who knew everything about this experiment, they chose teachers who they thought were equally competent. Classrooms with equal facilities. Everything as equal as possible, except for one thing. They named one Class A, the other one Class B. Without telling any of the children or their parents, they were as equal as you possibly could make based on the results of that end of year exam. 1 year later, when they gave the end of the year exam again after another year of schooling. The children who went to Class A did so much better than those who went into Class B. They became Class A children. And you can imagine why. When they went home, their parents said, "I don't know how you've done this, son, but carry on. Well done." The teachers expected more of them. They thought more of themselves that they could do these subjects. Well, those children who went into Class B, "You dummies, you should work harder. No special tricks for you. You have to do better next year." They thought themselves worse. But teachers, they didn't teach to such a high level. They became Class B children. They weren't Class B. But because they were told they were Class B, for one whole year, they thought they were Class B. They were treated as Class B. They became Class B children. And that is one of the problems with words that hurt. So you never try to judge any person by saying, "This is who you are." So I've seen that so often. Again, going back to my teaching years, that there was one kid. In my class, 30 children, one kid came bottom of the class. I had to give out the report cards, and as I gave out the report cards to this kid or that kid, when I gave it out to this boy and he opened this report card, bottom of the class, 30th in a class of 30. And you could see he never expected that. When he opened the report card, you could see his shoulders droop. His head was lowered. He showed all the signs of depression. And also fear. Fear of what his parents were going to say that night to him. Fear of what his friends were going to call him. Dummy, stupid, bottom of the class. So I saw that he was suffering. So as a compassionate Buddhist, as someone who can't just walk by someone who is in pain or depressed, I went up to him and I said, "I'm going to teach you some Buddhism." They knew I was a Buddhist because I taught them meditation. "I'm going to teach you the idea of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is a person who sacrifices their own happiness to save others. You are a Bodhisattva. I know you didn't need to come bottom of the class. You're much smarter than that. You could have come on the top 10. But you never thought about yourself. You thought about all your friends in this class. You took that terrible place of bottom of the class, knowing it's going to hurt you, to save your friends." All the other friends, they're conceited, thinking about themselves. "But you sacrificed. You are my hero. You are the Bodhisattva of this class, sacrificing yourself for others so your friends don't have to endure what you're going to get from your parents tonight." And I said, "After this class is finished, I'm going to go up to the principal's office and I'm going to recommend you Bodhisattva of the Year in this school." And as he looked at me, looking up from his desk, he thought, "I've got one of the craziest school teachers in the whole educational department in Devon." But at least it broke his depression as he laughed. When I knew, I'd taken him out of that terrible state of disappointment. And I did mention to him afterwards, "You are a Bodhisattva. But," I said, "you're only allowed to take the Bodhisattva prize once in your school life. Next year, let someone else come bottom, not you." What I was doing there was trying to take away that terrible thing of judgment. Of when we think we're bottom and then we don't ever try, ever again. We believe we can't do it. Now, this is where those words that hurt, stupid, ugly, hopeless, autistic, schizophrenic, criminal, those words people accept and they live by. They believe that's who they are. I, in my early life as a monk in the West, spent a lot of time in prisons, teaching meditation at first, and just getting to know some of the prisoners and learning so much from them. You know, it's a true story. The first time I taught in a jail, which was in the town of Bunbury in Western Australia. And when I went into the jail, I just could not believe how many prisoners came to my class. The number of prisoners in this jail was about 105, and about 102 came to my class. Imagine that turnout. Almost every prisoner wanted to learn meditation. And I thought, wow, I never thought that prisoners, murderers, thieves, fraudsters, were so interested in the spiritual life. And so I thought, wow, if they're so interested, I'm going to really teach them. And I only worked about 5 minutes of meditation. And this big fellow stood up in the middle of my talk. Can I ask a question? Normally you don't allow people to ask questions in the middle of the talk, maybe at the end. But this fellow was so big, about 6 foot, that was just across the shoulders. Scarred. Tough. Tattooed. I later found out he was one of the leaders of the gangs in the prison. And he asked. Anyway, as soon as he asked, I said, yeah, of course, ask a question. And he was the one who asked, is it really true that through meditation you can fly over walls? Now, sometimes I make up jokes, but that wasn't made up. That actually happened. When I told him, yeah, levitation can sometimes happen, but it takes many years, and only specially gifted meditators can do that. All the others usually use British Airways or Singapore Airways. Go a ladder or something. And so when I said that, when I went back next week to the meditation class, only 3 prisoners turned up. It was true. But in all those years which I went to prison, actually that same prisoner, when he was transferred to another jail, he was a rough fellow, but there was people being assaulted and raped inside the prison. Volunteers and visitors like me. Just because you were religious or volunteer or male was not going to save you. So the prison officers, as I checked in this jail, this high security jail, they gave me a little pen. And they said, this is not like a biro pen. It looks like a biro pen. But you press the button and aim it at what looks like the smoke detectors on the ceilings of this prison. And it's an alarm system. So if anyone tries to rape you or assault you, get your pen out, point it at one of the fire detectors, smoke alarms, press the button, we'll know where you are, we'll come and rescue you. They said, put it in your pocket. And I looked at the guy and said, pocket? I'm a monk. I don't have pockets. You have a great fun being a monk. You know, I'm going off on a tangent, but I haven't told this story during this trip, that I'm 68 now, and even though I can never have a pension, it's against our rules, I thought, I'm going to go and get myself a senior's card. It's called a senior's Commonwealth card in Australia, which you could have when you're 60, but I waited till 68. Why did I get one? Just because you can, that's all. So I thought it would be easy, just getting on a computer and putting in the details. But they said, no, you have to show up in person because there is what's called a personal identity theft. who we don't know who you really are. So please bring all your ID, come into the office so we can validate who you really are. She said, okay. So I went into the office. It took a bit of a while, 30 kilometers from our monastery. And the woman behind the counter said, oh, wonderful. Can you please prove who you are? And I told her, I'm a Buddhist monk. For 45 years, I've been trying to find an answer to that question. If you want me to say it now? You know, she didn't think I was funny. I said, I want some ID. I got your passport. I said, yeah, I've got a passport. I said, great, but that's not enough. Show us your driving license. I don't have a driving license. Monks don't drive. If we did drive, it would be so slow and mindful. And sometimes if somebody wanted to pass us, you know, please come in. We would be a hazard on the road. If we saw, say, like a cat or a dog, we'd stop, because we wouldn't want to harm any dogs or cats on the road. And if there were flies, you know, it's in some season, like gnats, when there's lots of flies in the area, we couldn't drive fast because we'll kill all those flies on the windscreen. So it's a good idea that monks and nuns don't drive. Number two, I don't have driving license. So let's see what else you have. Have you got your credit card? Don't have credit card. I'm a monk. Well, your bank account. I don't have a bank account. That's why I don't have a credit card. In our tradition, no, we have no money at all. He says, oh, well, what about your rental agreement for your room? No, I don't have that. What about your rates agreement for your house? Don't have that. I don't own anything. Oh. And what they asked for next just made me laugh. What about your marriage certificate? I don't have one of those. And all the things they asked me for, I don't have. And they said, you don't exist. According to government, you just don't exist. And I said, ah, the Buddha was right. No self. So life is really fun as a monk. So actually, I did have got two passports, you know, one for Britain and one for Australia. So not really supposed to do two passports, but she took pity on me and proved that I do exist after all, but only just. Anyway, so back to where I was with the prisoner. Put the pen in your pocket. I don't have a pocket. Well, just hold it. Okay. So I went into my meditation class, and this prisoner, he saw me. Oh, welcome, Ajahn Brahm. You have one of those security devices too. It's supposed to be top secret. Everybody knows what's going on. It's a waste of time trying to keep a secret. So I said, yeah. And he looked at me, and he said, you really think that you could press that button and point it at one of those security alarms on the ceiling before I could rape you? And I said, no. And he said, correct. We're way too fast. But you know, I wasn't at all scared, because he continued. He said, but if any of these behind me tried that stuff, I'd get to them first. Because you've been kind to us and served us and treated us well, there's no way that can ever happen to you in this jail. It was one of those amazing feelings of safety, that because you've been kind, that they would never harm you. And sometimes I wondered, how come I've been kind? How come they treat me with such protection inside jail? And of course, later on, I received, it's on the same subject, later on I received this phone call from one of the prison officers which I will cherish. It's one of those little pieces of praise which were so precious to me. Because he called me, he wanted to call to me in particular, saying, please come back to our jail to teach. And I said, I'm really busy. I've got to go to London, to the Rudolf Steiner place, to all these other engagements which I have to do. But I'll send somebody else. They say, no, we want you. And of course, the next question was, why me? And that's when he said that his sincere compliment, which was so rare, that it was wonderful, it went right to my heart, and I keep this as one of the kindest compliments, the kindest words which I've ever had. And it was, we want you, because I've been in this prison service for such a long time, I'm about to retire. Every prisoner, no matter who they were, who came to your class, once released, never came back again. He said, I've never seen them with any other person in my whole life as a prison officer. I don't know what you've been doing, we want you back to do it again. And that made me really contemplate, what had I done? And the answer was, you looked way beyond what that person had been in prison for. To the point that I had never seen in all those years going into prisons, I'd never seen a criminal. I've never seen a thief. I've never seen a murderer, or a rapist, or a fraudster. I've never seen any of those in jail. All I've ever seen was a person who committed a crime, a person who had murdered, a person who had raped, a person who had stolen, but never a thief. To understand the difference, if you call a person a murderer, that's all you're seeing, that's all they are. Just like the Class B kids, that's all they hear, and they become that. The thief, once they're released from jail, becomes a thief because that's their identity, that's who they think they are. But looking beyond that, they're a person who's done so much more in their life than just those terrible acts for which they've been incarcerated. It doesn't lessen the harm and just the pain and suffering which they've inflicted upon others. But to look beyond that, there's more to them than that Class B act which they performed. Which means when they are released from jail, when they've done their time, the other part of them can grow and flourish. That's why they never need to come back again. And the same thing was with people with sicknesses. That's why I'm quite passionate, and maybe some doctors here, some psychologists, psychiatrists in that profession. I think it's quite inaccurate and actually imprisoning to call someone schizophrenic. There are people who have episodes of schizophrenia. And I was telling this story once when I was giving a lecture as part of the Singapore Mental Health Department celebration of 50 years up in Woodlands, in the north of Singapore. And they were trying to make a mental health hub. In other words, getting the top of the range treatment for all these diseases so people could come from other parts of Southeast Asia for treatment. So when I gave my talk, after my talk, this professor of one of the units in the Singapore mental health units said, I like your talk very much. I'm a Catholic, but can you come and bless my ward? Buddhists don't bless Catholic wards. He said, no. Please come. And I thought, why? He said, because your talk describes how I treat my patients. I said, what ward are you in? He said, I'm the professor, the head of schizophrenia in Singapore. How do you treat your patients? how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore? He said, just as you said, I do not treat schizophrenia as a professor of schizophrenia in the Singapore Mental Health Complex. I thought, wow, this is interesting. What do you do then? I treat the other part of the person, the part that is not schizophrenic. And the few things, Sri Lankans here, I worship, I put my hands up, sadhu, 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 to that professor. At last, somebody understands basic psychology of the human being. Imagine you call a person a schizophrenic. Imagine that they do exhibit some of those behavior. They're becoming the class B schizophrenic person. Look beyond that. There's more to them than that. Focus on the other part of them. And the other part of them starts to grow. But if you call someone stupid from the very beginning, those are not just words that hurt. That's words which imprison a person for the rest of their life. They become that. I love cutting edge science, psychology, schizophrenia, anything which is weird or scientific, which challenges, I really like, because sometimes I see that things aren't working. And so, because of that when a person came up to my monastery, they wanted to become a monk, and they were schizophrenic. What to do? Could I handle schizophrenia as a Buddhist monk? And I gave them a chance. I looked at not just their schizophrenic behavior, but the other part of them. And I'm so proud that that monk is now a senior monk, a Thera, teaching, helping out writing stuff, and one of the marvelous success stories. And anyone who ever saw him would never ever think that he was on clozapine, schizophrenic, but living a wonderful life, mindful, aware. And one of the main teachings was, you are not a schizophrenic. Don't label yourself that. You're a monk, a person, a being, who sometimes can have the schizophrenic fantasies and delusions. But you know you're much more than that. And keeping on focusing on the positive part, keeping on emphasizing that, making sure he sees that, then the schizophrenia is almost not discernible at all. It's wonderful little things, because you don't just talk about this. I practice this stuff. And it's the same with sicknesses. Have you got cancer? Are you a cancer patient? Or are you a person who has cancer? Sometimes you're not a sick person. You're a person who has sickness. There's more to you, you know, than the results of those biopsies or scans. Unfortunately, we have what some people call disabled people. If someone gives you that label, you're disabled. What a terrible label to give somebody. It's as if that's all they are, and there's nothing more to them than their disability. So I don't call them disabled anymore. They are different. They have different abilities. And I learned that, you know, I went to Cambridge University, there were scholarships all the way, and as theoretical physics, I would have bumped into Stephen Hawking. I certainly went to the lectures of his teacher, Professor Sharma. I remember him. But I think Professor Hawking would have been a bit older, so not really in my age group. But nevertheless, I had a few friends who were quite devout Christians, and I was a Buddhist. And they decided to do their social work. They were volunteering at Fulbourne Hospital for those who had mental infirmities. And I said, I was a Buddhist. And so I decided to go and do social work, not out of compassion, out of keeping up with the Joneses. If the Christians could do it, I could do it too. Total, you know, young person's arrogance. So I went there on a Thursday afternoon, and I must, this is accurate, that my Christian friends, they lasted 2 or 3 weeks. I went there for 2 years. Every Thursday afternoon. And the only reason I went there, it was not to actually do social work anymore. I really enjoyed it. And I was helping out in the OT, the occupational therapy department, for those who were diagnosed with Down syndrome. And I was stunned just how intelligent they were emotionally. To the point that I always recall arriving, getting off the bus, walking, you know, through the grounds towards the unit, and one of these young men diagnosed as Down syndrome took one look at me, came running towards me, put his arms around me, asked me how I was. He'd never done that before. I said, "Why?" He said, "Something's happened, you're sad. I've broken up with my girlfriend the night before." He picked it up straight away. His emotional sensitivity was astounding. No one else could pick that up. But these fellows, they could see it straight away. Their emotional intelligence was worthy of a Nobel Prize. I preferred hanging around with them much more than hanging around with professors at Cambridge. You learn much more. Not about the words, but about the kindness and sensitivity. That was really important to me. And so from there, are these disabled people lesser beings? Of course not. That's why it's wonderful in our modern society where people who sometimes would be institutionalized, separated, so you wouldn't see them, are right in the middle of things. Not as lesser human beings, but beings with different qualities, but important qualities from which we can all learn. Not to be looked upon with isn't it terrible, isn't it bad? But looked upon with respect. What have you got to teach us? And so sometimes disabilities, sicknesses, how do we look upon them? And sometimes, oh, isn't it terrible? That by itself are words which hurt. Imagine you're a person who has been diagnosed with, say, I don't know, what is it, obsessive compulsive disorder or something. Oh, isn't it terrible? Is it? Straight away, you're putting a box around them. It's words which confine and hurt. Words which free and say, just like that bodhisattva kid, you only do this one, next year you can do anything. Give them the freedom. Autism. You know, these days, we used to call it autistic, but now it's autistic spectrum. In other words, I was going to say disorder, but I'm not going to say that. It's totally different. People see things in a different way. So they've got abilities which other people don't have. It's just that sometimes that we cannot sort of understand how to fit them into our lives. But if we have that wisdom, the capacity to give those words, the kind words, you're welcome. You're not being separated. You belong. You're not lesser than anybody else. We want to find the place where you can fit in. You belong. Words which heal and help. There's so many people, probably even in this audience, who think they're not worthy. They don't belong. They haven't found their place in life. I've said this story already a couple of times in this talk, but it's a very important story. A simile. The simile of the forest. I've told this story to many people who have suffered, you know, from being different, whether it's people with so-called mental difficulties, people who somehow don't fit in, people who are they don't look the same as you, people with not the same sexual orientation, people who are different. And sometimes they get hurt because they feel they don't belong. They don't do well at school, they're not well at sport, they can't get the same job we get, they can't do this, they can't do that, they're stigmatized, marginalized, feel to be lesser. And I say the story. If you think you don't belong, that there's something wrong with you, please go for a walk in a forest, a natural forest, not a park or plantation, a natural forest, even somewhere around London. It's a long time since I've been to those forests like Epping Forest or wherever, but go to a wood or forest somewhere and find a perfect tree for me. A tree which is straight, with all of the branches equally spaced, with the branches straight, with the twigs on them and leaves all nicely spaced, no leaves which have been eaten by the bugs, no branches which have fallen off, nothing twisted or bent. If you can find such a tree like that, you'll be the first one. I live in a forest, I'm a forest monk, I've never seen a perfect tree. Even that sometimes when I've been to Germany, German people love their forests. I've never seen them going into the Black Forest with sandpaper to make sure there's no scars or something on the barks of the trees. In fact, no one would ever think of doing that. Number one, there's no perfect trees in any forest. And number two, the ones which are the most twisted and bent and damaged are the most beautiful trees in the forest. So don't go and find the most perfect tree. Find the most beautiful tree. And you'll find the most beautiful tree in the forest, the ones which are twisted and bent and damaged and scarred. They're the ones you want to visit again and again and again, and have your photograph taken underneath it. And the meaning of that story is, every tree belongs, just like every human being, no matter who you are, no matter what race, religion, age, abilities or lack of abilities, every human being belongs in this great forest called humanity, human beings. And number two, if you are twisted and bent by life, scarred and damaged by the storms of which you didn't make happen, which have scarred you, damaged you, twisted you, you are some of the most beautiful trees in the forest. Welcome. Those are words that help and heal. Not words that hurt and separate. Sometimes the words that hurt are just words that separate, which cause divisions in our world, which make people on the other side of those walls feel they're not connected with the other people on the other side of the wall. Divisions. Separations. Recently, it was a year and a half ago, that's right, September last year, that I was invited to do a peace event in South Korea. Actually, not quite South Korea. It was in the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas. You may have remembered at the time that President Kim Jong-un of North Korea had fallen in love with President Trump. That's what the newspapers were saying. So anyway, real people, the Buddhists of the Jogye Order over in South Korea, who I associate with a lot, that they wanted to do an event, a peace event. And so they got some very senior monks to go over there, and they wanted one of those monks to go on a peace walk inside the DMZ, that's what they call it because it was American, DMZ, Demilitarized Zone, with 6,000 lay and monk people from the Jogje Buddhist Korean Order. They wanted one of the senior monks to go. You know who went? Me, because I was fit. Believe it or not, I am very fit. Well, the other ones, the senior monks, they were old. And so they couldn't walk not that far. So it was a 3-hour walk, about, I think it was, we walked really fast actually to finish our allotted time in there, and it was about 13 or 14 kilometres. We really had to walk fast to actually finish this walk. It was in a DMZ. Very dangerous. And there was lots of shooting in there. I've got to admit, be truthful, lots of shooting. And honestly, I was shot many times. Really? With cameras. I can't avoid a bit of humour inside this talk. But anyway, that while you were in there, that DMZ, that you could see that many of the people who were walking with me, who were South Koreans, were crying. Because on the other side were family and friends, close relations they hadn't seen for I don't know how many years. They didn't know if they would ever see them, whether there'd be any reconciliation before they all died. And it was so painful to see a division like that, people of the same race, people who love one another, have been separated for almost ever. Walls between people, peoples, between religions, between philosophies cause so many problems. So, to understand how we can say words of kindness, good words which bring people together, rather than stigmatize people. This is a story which I said recently. I was giving a conference. As a Buddhist monk, I get to such really interesting invitations. I showed Venerable Chandra that next year on October the 31st, Halloween's night, I've got an invitation to Real Australian Ghostbusters conference. Yeah. We're going to talk how different religions or different people deal with ghosts and hauntings. So, wow, that's really cool. So I haven't done that conference before, so I'm going to do that one. Talk about some ghosts. But anyway, this... this particular conference was just an ordinary, just interfaith conference, but it was high level. How many wars and conflicts do we still experience when it seems like climate change is just so pressing, we still have to worry about fighting. Ministry of, UK, we call it Ministry of Defence. I call it Ministry of Attack. Is it? Anyway, a lot of it is. Anyway, if you go back to all the religions and stuff, fighting wars. At this conference, we're trying to find ways of seeing and looking to lessen conflict. So, I was asked by this intellectual, the sort of person I cannot tell a joke to, far too serious. He was a Jesuit who was so well regarded intellectually, a professor of so many things, that he was appointed by the Australian government to write the addition to the Australian Constitution on Human Rights. Father Frank Brennan. Don't know if there's any Australians here tonight, but you know, he's quite well known. So he came to this conference and he put me on the spot by asking, Ajahn Brahm, what is the Buddhist idea of God? Now many of you who are Buddhists will say, no, you're an atheist, you don't believe in God, or whatever. Oh yeah, you believe in this God or that God or whatever. But those sorts of answers perpetuate divisions and walls. So I managed to, I was co-presenting with a Benedictine abbot, Abbot Placid. He was a Catholic abbot, became a really good friend, and we used to talk secret abbot business, because I was an abbot, he was an abbot, there was no other abbots to talk to. So we had a wonderful time, and I remember just, he had this really old monastery in Western Australia, a couple of hundred years old, and when he took me around it, now, I asked him, are there any ghosts in this monastery? He said, I'm a Catholic. We don't believe in ghosts. He took the bait so innocently. And then I told him, what about the Holy Ghost? I knew you were sneaky. But he did the same to me. We had a great time together, cracking jokes. I remember also going to, we went to the first ordination of the Anglican bishop, female, in Perth. She's now the first and only Anglican archbishop. I went to ordination. And going to the Anglican ordination, quite frankly, it's not putting down the Anglican church, it's so boring. It takes 2 hours. And so I was sitting next to my friend, the Catholic abbot, Abbot Placid, and also the United Church Minister. And we were sitting in a front sort of pew, the heretics pew. We were getting so bored, we started telling jokes to one another. You know, like naughty boys in church did when I was young. It hadn't changed much. So that passed the time. Anyway, he was one of my really good friends. So much so that, he asked me to speak at his, when he passed away, when he died, when he had this really big formal funeral, because he was an abbot of a Benedictine monastery. They asked me to give a speech at his, it really touched me, because they know that we're really close together. Forget about being a Buddhist or being a Catholic or whatever, we were friends. We loved each other. But anyway, he was next to me, and I said to this Father Frank Brennan, you know this, my really close friend, the Catholic abbot, he keeps on telling me, this is what he said, that one of his fundamental beliefs was that everybody is searching for God. That's what he said. Don't react. Because someone said, no, that's, I've been there, done that, no. Don't react. So I don't react. Because he's my friend. And I respect what he says, even if I may not believe it at first. I respect him. He's a sincere, honest, straightforward abbot. Committed. So I said to Father Frank Brennan, I said, well, let's start from that. If everyone is searching for God, what does, say, Buddhist search for? What do atheists are searching for? What do I search for? You search for peace, reconciliation, forgiveness. You search for respect. I like being respected, even though I wear these funny clothes. And I try to give respect to everybody else, no matter where they're from, no matter how they dress, no matter what they believe. To give respect. Have you ever felt you're not respected? You're not understood? To give this love, this open the door of your heart, no matter who you are, you can come in. To give that love and feel that love is coming from others towards me. We search for love and to be loved, to be cared for. We search for truth and meaning in our life. What other things do you search for? If that's what everyone is searching for, and my friend says everyone is searching for God, that must be what God means. The respect. for kindness, for happiness, for meaning, for truth, for love. Not a being in the sky, but something which you can feel, something which you can know, things which you value. You're searching for trust, searching for growth, so you can understand yourself sometimes through the eyes of another. Searching just to have a friend you can talk with and not be criticized. You're searching for being allowed to make mistakes on your journey through life without being criticized, so you can grow. We search for having a world which we can know respect and leave for later generations. How many things are you searching for? Put those all into this idea of like a God. Then the God-believing people of this world, you've made contact with them. You've taken down walls, things which can unite us, which are important, which have meaning, and which take our community further. Those are words which break down walls and barriers, not words which make barriers, which separate us. So remember this, Father Fred Brennan, wow, that's amazing. And of course you can only get these ideas on the spot, off the cuff. Actually I don't wear cuffs, but anyway, you know what I mean. Off the road. So sometimes, to get the nice words, the words which take our understanding of life deeper, we have to just meditate, be still, and trust what comes out from our mouths when we're coming from the right place. They do become words which heal. Words which see past the hurt which somebody might have given you. Words which reach the other person and make them your friend, so they can be with you forever. A kind word is really just so rare in this world that it's treasured. Thank you. And you mean it. I care for you. And you mean it. And I respect you. And you mean it. Those are words which heal. You know that you need those, and even I need those as well. So sometimes I can say a stupid joke. What did I say that for? You're laughing because she's been travelling with me the last week or two. I don't know how many stupid jokes she's endured. But you know what happens when you tell a bad joke? They remember it, they tell somebody else afterwards. For example, I got this from a doctor in Singapore. What is the last part of your body which stops working when you die? The last part which turns off before you die. I always thought it was like the brain. I says, no. The last part which stops is your eyes. Only your eyes dilate. So poor Sister Chanda, I don't know how many times she's heard that, but nevertheless she understands. But that's Vajabram. And so that's just respecting one another, being kind to one another, and even being so kind, she keeps on laughing at all of my jokes. Thank you very much. Okay, so that is the talk so far. Now we have time for questions and answers and comments and complaints. Okay, if you want to clap, you can. So, who wants to ask the first question? It can be what I've talked about tonight or anything else. Yes.
And what about words that really hurt from a loved one?
okay, talking about words which hurt, you know, from a loved one, which really cause a lot of problems, that mean family or parents or even a partner. But when you do receive such words which hurt, if it's from not really a close partner, just like a family member, sometimes they do that to try and, as they say, push buttons. In brief, I was told by Ajahn Chah when he was still alive, one of the worst words you could call somebody was as a dog, like a cur, like a mongrel. And he said, if anybody, Ajahn Brahm, if anyone ever calls you a dog, have a look at your bottom. See if you have a tail. I haven't got a tail, so I'm not a dog. In other words, don't allow the other person's anger or stupidity to affect you. Somebody calls you stupid, and you think, why did they call me stupid? I'm not stupid. They've got no right to call me stupid. And if you're mindful enough, you realize they've just called you stupid 3 more times. Every time you remember it, they're calling you a bad name again. And actually, if that's how you behave, they were right. You are stupid. By not letting it go immediately. No one can hurt us if we don't allow them to hurt us. You have a choice. Choice to believe what other people say, or choice to know who you are. Sometimes they're right. You're allowed to make mistakes. So don't try and be perfect. Don't try and be the perfect tree in the forest which doesn't exist. Be fallible. Make mistakes. Making mistakes is just some of the most beautiful moments of my life when I've got things wrong. Such as when I was called up to the hospital, an emergency. An elderly Chinese Buddhist was in the ICU in a coma dying. And the family had come over from Singapore or Hong Kong or Taiwan, from mainland China, to be with their patriarch in the last moments. And they called me in, emergency, rushed into the ICU to do some Buddhist chanting. And my Buddhist chanting is really strong when I'm on form. Not all the time. But this time I was really on my game. And I really chanted for this guy. He came out of the coma. Honest. And even the doctors were surprised. He was going to survive. He wasn't going to die. And that is when the family, I thought they'd be so pleased. But no, they were so angry. I said, Brahm, we've already arranged the funeral. Now we're going to have to stop it, and it costs a lot of money. We've all come, stopped our businesses for a few days to be with our father, our grandfather, and uncle for the last time. Now you've ruined everything. He's going to die again, maybe in 6 months, so we have to come back when he dies again properly, but we won't invite you next time. Because they'd expected him to die. They made all the arrangements. And invited a monk, and he didn't die. And I scolded him, I said, listen, it's your fault, you didn't tell me what chanting to do. There's 2 types of chanting, the get better chant or the die peaceful chant. And I did the wrong one. So now when anybody ever asks me to do some chanting for something or other, I always ask them, what chanting do you want, please? Die peaceful or get better chant. So sometimes when people criticize me, I see the funny side. They can't harm me or hurt me. So don't let, if your, say, wife says you're a class B husband, don't believe that. Be stubborn and prove her wrong. No, I'm a Class A, and I'm going to show you. I'm being extra kind, and extra wonderful, whatever it is. But it's also the case that sometimes when a person says something to hurt you, they don't just say it, they shout it at you. And somebody once told me this, this was actually a year or two ago. Why do family members or couples, lovers, shout? You only shout at someone if they're a long distance away. That's the only way you can connect with them. But sometimes you shout with your wife when you're in the same room. Physically, you are close. It shows emotionally you're very distant. And when you are emotionally close, you don't need to shout, you can whisper. You hear one another. So raising your voice is a sign, not that she's a long distance away, except emotionally, she's far from you. It's a wonderful perception. So, if people say hard things, a lot of times they don't mean it. Sometimes it's their sickness or their illness or something happening. So give them the benefit of the doubt. They say a bad thing about you, just let it wash over you. And always respond with some kindness. So, okay, the little story of the husband who went to the market. It's a nice one. There was a husband, this was in Asia somewhere, and the husband had the afternoon off work, and the wife said, "Darling, I need some eggs, you know, for dinner tonight. I haven't got enough. Can you go to the market and buy some eggs for me? I've never been to the market before. Doesn't matter, I'll give you the basket, I'll write the instructions and give you the money so you can go and get it for me." "Certainly, darling, anything for you." He's a really nice husband. So off he went to the market to get his wife some eggs. And as soon as he entered the market, this young man, maybe about 18, came straight up to him and said, "My goodness, you're the ugliest person I've ever seen in my whole life. You've got a face like a camel, the back end of a camel, that is. And I don't know what aftershave you're using, but it smells like dog poo. You are idiot. You are smelly. You are ugly." And he said many more worse things than that. "But I have a nice nun sitting next to me, and I know, she's very sensitive. So I don't want to. And anyway, I don't know all those nasty words. Honestly, I don't. I'm a monk." So anyway, said all these nasty, rotten words to this fellow. Now for about 10 or 15 minutes. And this husband, "I don't even know you." But that just made this little young man say even worse things. So eventually the husband turned around and went home. Went home, slammed the door. And the wife said, "You're home early, darling." "Yes, but don't you ever send me to that stupid market ever again. People are just so uncouth, uncivilized. They say terrible words to me." And he went on like this for a long time. Until he eventually calmed down. The wife said, "What happened?" And when he told the story, this young man had abused him in public. And he'd done nothing wrong at all. Called him camel face and dog poo smell. And the wife said, "Oh, him. That poor young man hit his head when he was young. He's brain damaged. He will never be able to go to school, never be able to get a job, never be able to find a nice girl to share his life with. He's brain damaged. Oh, he says worse things to me, worse things to others, but because of his injuries, oh, we don't mind. We don't take it seriously because he's crazy, he's mad." And as soon as the husband heard that, all his anger just vanished. And as soon as the wife saw that he was now at peace, no anger left, his wife said to him, "Darling, I still need those eggs." As I said, certainly. And don't worry about that poor brain damaged kid. So husband went back to the market. The young man came up to him again and called him camel face and dog poo smell and all sorts of other terrible names. But the husband never cared now because, oh, the poor thing, he had brain damage. And so he went to the market, got to the egg store, got to the egg store, abused all the way to the egg store, all the way back again, but it didn't matter at all. How can you be upset when you're being abused by someone who's brain damaged? So the moral of that story, if your family member says bad things about you, just assume they must have hit their head today. They're brain damaged. Because abuse and anger is called in Buddhism temporary insanity. Okay, so that's a little answer to that question. Okay, we've got one and then two, yeah.
Sure. Thank you very much, Ajahn, for a beautiful talk, first of all. Question is...
That's words which heal. Thank you.
And also lovely to see you, Venerable. Yeah. Question is about written communication.
Yeah.
A lot of us communicate in writing, on social media these days.
Yes, yeah.
Journalism and fiction, I'm often the same thing. And I'm wondering if you have any advice on that type of communication.
Oh, yeah, email etiquette. Sometimes if you write an email, wait. Don't send it immediately. And then read it again an hour later. Sometimes you can see afterwards, what would a person think in this email which I've just written? Especially on sensitive matters. Because you, when you're writing to a computer screen, which is what you're really doing, you know, if I'm talking to you, I'm actually watching for your responses, your facial, your facial responses, and I know if I'm going too far or I'm not going far enough by, you know, how you react. So you don't have those cues when we're writing at a screen. So a lot of time we can say really stupid bad things, which we regret afterwards. So if you get a nasty email from somebody, don't judge them too harshly. Because who they were really writing to was the computer screen, not you. So they email it to you, they send it to you, and they don't realise what they said. Or realise they know what it said, but the emotions behind them, the reactions, are not what they intended. I always like giving people the benefit of the doubt. Sometimes in a court of law, we have the prosecution makes their case first of all. They always have the defence afterwards. And so whenever I judge somebody, I notice that sometimes if I'm upset, the prosecutor has the first argument. And the defence never even has a chance to say anything. They're guilty. You said a lot of things here on the piece of paper. This is what you said. But if you have the defence attorney, you say, oh, well, maybe they didn't mean that. Maybe they're in a bad mood. Maybe they even didn't write it. Maybe that's not what they meant. So we give people the benefit of the doubt. If you give people the benefit of the doubt, we have a much happier world. Well, just ask them afterwards, is that what you really meant? Well, they say, no, that's not what I meant. So be careful. And then sometimes you don't offend people.
Does that
answer the question?
Yeah, thanks for that.
Okay, the question
for you. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. I find that people tend to say things, harsh words, and it goes both ways, me and other people, out of fear. And I suppose my question is, are you any advice around how to deal with that fear? Sometimes you can see it on kind of people's faces when they say things to you, and it's just out of fear.
Yeah, well, you'd ask me, what do you do when people say harsh things to you? A lot of times that we talk to one another because, you know, we want to solve some problems, we want some action. You know, I look after a monastery with a lot of monks, and some of those monks do stupid things. I do stupid things too, but I found that it's like as a manager, you know, which is what I'm doing practically, that if you say kind things to those monks, they try even harder to help. If you shout at them, stupid monk, how many times have I told you not to snore when you're meditating? You know, you're disturbing everybody. You're a monk, you should not be able to do that. You know, you're disturbing the peace of everybody. What type of monk do you think you are?
Disarm the fear in them as well.
Yeah, well, what happens then if I just say that to them? they don't want to engage anymore. I'm being disrespectful, not understanding. When I say to them, oh, you know, you're very sleepy, just go off and go back to bed. And then you find that this monk cares for me, understands me. So they want to try harder for me. You get people on side. This is something which, okay, might be controversial, but say with the climate extinction protests, it's a really important cause. The only way it's going to really have traction is you get the other side, so-called enemies, on your side. Respect them. Respect them so much that they want to be part of know what you're talking about. Otherwise, if it's, it doesn't matter what the cause is, what amazing, wonderful cause, if you have enemies, especially powerful enemies, they can stop you. At least they can delay. So somehow or other, you don't get angry or upset. All the other people, say in London, who really want to do something about our climate, get them on board by not offending them. Then, when you can work together, it's amazing what we can perform together. That's our power, to unite rather than to oppose. Okay, it's over there, yes. Okay.
Thank you, Azam. The question I have relates to the subject of situation of modern Buddhism and the discussion between different groups of Buddhists, because there are like many, maybe not traditions, but currents of Buddhists, for example, like secular Buddhism, and there are people who are saying things like rebirth and Nibbana is fairy tales and stuff like that, and they call themselves Buddhists. And sometimes I feel like we should stand up and just get like a discussion with them to show the suttas and all the truth about Buddhism. And but on the other hand, I suppose we have to guard ourselves to be kind in this discussion. Because you're saying about this uniting people,
yeah.
So how to get this balance between being unity and on the other hand protect our healthy boundaries to don't let unroll the situation, as you call in your book Banana Nibbana, and in general putting down the standards of Buddhism, so called.
Yeah, lowering the standards. Or respecting, you know, some of these truths in Buddhism. But you'll find the more that you become an evangelical fundamentalist Buddhist, the more you disengage with the people who want to practice or see differently. So you become separated, you never meet. So first of all, you're kind. First of all, you don't give fear to the other people. And then when you unite and you're kind, then people will listen. And who knows? You may be the person who's wrong. So we're never arrogant enough to think that we're right and everyone else is wrong. Personally, I'm on your side. So if you're wrong, I'm in big trouble. But not that. After a while, that sometimes, even this is something which was said in Christianity, by your actions you shall know them. So whatever you believe is one thing, but how you practice that is even more important. There was an old story, I haven't said it for a long time, that Gandhi, he studied here in London before he became well known as a very wise spiritual being. But when he was practicing here in, I think, law, he was staying with a landlady in a sort of boarding house. And the landlady came after him one day and said, "My son is eating too much sugar. It's bad for him. I've been telling him many times the lessons in taking sugar, but he doesn't respect me. For some reason he looks up to you, Mr. Gandhi. He respects you. Can you please tell him not to eat so much sugar?" "Yes, ma'am," said Mr. Gandhi. And after a couple of weeks, the landlady went up to him once more and said, "Do you remember that conversation we had a fortnight ago, when you promised to talk to my son so he doesn't eat so much sugar?" "Yes, ma'am." "Why haven't you done that? He's still eating lots of sugar." And that's where Gandhi said, "I only talked to him this morning, ma'am. Why did you wait so long?" "Because it took me 2 weeks to give up eating sugar myself." And that's what makes people great people. To make sure that if you want to protect anything, make sure you have the power to do so by your integrity, by your practice, by your understanding. I totally agree with you. Secular Buddhism, what is secular Buddhism anyway? Why do we give it that name? Buddhism, Buddhism, Buddhism. It's all Buddhism, or whatever. It's all truth, it's all meaning. So after a while, you follow what you want to follow. And you find the truth of that. And if that really is the truth, if it works, it will grow. I always wanted to know who this philosopher was. I read it a long time ago. The best way of negating bad ideas is to promote good ideas with greater vigor. Not to waste your time arguing against wrong ideas, but just to focus on good ideas with, you know, greater commitment. And anyway, just, okay, whole idea of like people who don't believe in reincarnation or rebirth. I always tell them, don't worry about them, because they will believe in reincarnation in their next life. Well, I can guarantee. Sorry. There's another question at the top there somewhere? Yeah. I was just looking that way. And then please come down so it can come down to other places. You've got the microphone there, it helps.
Hi. A really good question. I have noticed sometimes when especially people are upset talking to me, that in reality they're talking to themselves, I'm acting as a mirror, but I don't know what to tell them or how to behave in those situations.
Yeah, if they're talking to you and it's being upsetting, you don't know how to behave. Sometimes, sorry, yeah? Acting as a mirror to them, yes. Okay, you're acting as a mirror. Okay. Sometimes that, a lot of times people just do need to listen, you just need to let them talk, to let them vent, let them unload, without reacting back. But sometimes that when they unload on you, it's like, I can chart over this, it's like they're dumping on you. And if they dump a lot of rubbish on you, you are like the rubbish bin. He said you have to be a rubbish bin for your friends and loved ones. But always remember to be a rubbish bin with a hole in the bottom. So they dump on you and you keep nothing, but right through you. So you're always open to the next person to dump on you. And sometimes being not judgmental and being kind is a wonderful thing. Because they know, again, they're not criticizing you. It's not about you, it's about them. I often notice this, that like husbands and wives come home from work and they dump because they've had a terrible day at work. They say all sorts of wrong things. The only reason is because they think they're safe dumping on the loved ones. So you've got to understand, it's not about you, darling. Oh, I had a terrible day at work. If that's the case, after they call you all sorts of bad names, And you're just a mirror. Just give them a hug and say, I understand. Don't defend yourself, because you've got nothing to defend. So I've seen that many times. The reason why they're angry at you, or they appear to be angry at you, because psychologically they think that you understand it's not about you, it's just they're hurting. Okay, where's the microphone? Okay, it's coming over to this gentleman first, I think. And then it goes inside.
Hello, first of all, thank you for the talk. And I'm coming from Georgia, which is very far and predominantly Christian country.
Yeah.
And your talks helped me through the YouTube to convert into Buddhism and to find an inner peace for myself. And I will forever be grateful for you for that, first of all. What I want to ask is sort of your recommendations, because for myself, in a way, I have found an inner peace, or more or less. But there are people around me who suffer a lot, and they often rely on me to be that healing. However, some of them have developed this habit of continuously hurting themselves because it's so into their habit that they don't know and how to find another way. And for me, from my point of view, to talking to them about, let's say, Four Noble Truths or Noble and Folded Path, for them, and how to sit in the meditation, it's hard for them to understand. However, they always look up to me in a way that, can you help me? And however, they stay in this circle of pain because that's what they are, get used to. So how can I amplify this sort of healing?
Well, you're already helping them, because that's why they keep coming back. And sometimes that they have that simile of the elephant who lost its happiness. Just associating with good, kind people. Just associating with them. Sometimes the things they pick up which you don't give them is because who you are. And just, you open the door of your heart to them. Say, it hurts me to see you hurt. If that's what you want to do, I give you permission to hurt yourself. What that actually does is actually just totally give them a different way of looking at things. They just can't do it anymore. And I say that because that last June I was going to a conference in Berkeley, and they had this wonderful idea that you can even pay for a ticket if you can afford it, or you can send a story of why you want to go there for free. And this is one girl, she lost her, I think her mother and father died tragically, she was only about 16 or 17, Sarah her name was, and she wanted to commit suicide. And she was really at the end, and she listened again to one of the YouTube talks, and she interpreted that it's okay to commit suicide. This, well, I don't know if I said that, but you won't be criticised. The door of my heart will be open to you, whatever you do. And that just changed her whole attitude. It was amazingly deep psychology. It was, I love you whatever you do. I'm not going to sort of tell you what to do spiritually. I was just seeing what she understood was just expanding the boundaries and not demonizing anything. That she would be loved no matter what she did. And that just totally changed her. And of course, she never committed suicide, but she said, thank you for saying it's all right to commit suicide. So she never did. Psychology is very profound. And sometimes even psychologists don't get it totally. But she came to the conference because what she said is what conferences are all about. Not just repeating old stories, but seeing things totally differently. They're hurting themselves. They've already got lack of self-esteem. And by hurting themselves, don't do that. Yeah, it hurts me to see you do that, because that's what you want to do. You're still my friend. I'm not going to be a control freak telling you what to do. I'm just making this up as I go along. It may not work. It's an example of just how you use this wisdom. It doesn't come from the books, which comes from the moment, from stillness and from kindness. It is really powerful. A few times that having to deal with situations I've never been trained for, never learnt about, is where I get the saying, never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Everything you know about Buddhism, about psychology, drop that. Just be with a person. You say some crazy things. They're coming from peace, they're coming from stillness, they're coming from the heart. And they work in amazing ways. So expand your kindness and wisdom. See what happens. About the person doesn't criticize me anymore. I belong like the trees in the forest. And they don't need to harm themselves anymore. Because they're part of things. Rather than being excluded or feeling there's something wrong with them, they don't fit in. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a dangerous teaching, I must admit. But you only do that when you feel it's your appropriate time. Okay.
Hi, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here. My question is related to the words that hurt. What if you talked earlier about how to react when you're on the receiving end and someone is not very kind? What, for example, if I were the person who, in a moment of bad mood,
yeah,
says something and then the other person is not
really,
it's not a Buddhist, or
does
not know how to react or how to
yeah.
let go, how do you move on from that?
Well, of course, first thing you say is sorry. And number two is to impress upon that person you're with that you're not perfect. I mean, whoever you're with is probably a close partner or something, and you may remind your partner they're not perfect either, which is why you're a good match. But one of the other things about making mistakes is to allow yourself to make mistakes. And don't be embarrassed about it. Maybe your partner at the time just really upset, or the friend upset. Then afterwards you say, look, I lost it, I shouldn't have said that, I was in a bad mood. I'm still growing as a human being. And you can mention to them what I've described as a 70% rule, which I got from being a school teacher again, setting my first math exam, and I didn't know what to do, so I asked a senior math teacher and said, don't make it too difficult. If the exam is too difficult, then your students get 30 or 40% average score. They'll come away thinking they can't do math. It's not that they can't do it, the exam was too hard. So you've taken away their motivation, or they're thinking they can do this. If it's too easy, they all get 95 or 100%, it's not worth doing the exam at all. You should aim for the average score of 70%, 7 out of 10. That's a pretty good score, it means you can do mathematics, but the most important part, the 30% where they make mistakes, that's where me as their teacher can learn their weaknesses, and that's what I can focus on in the lessons afterwards. 70% is a pretty good score, and the 30% which you make mistakes you should never be embarrassed about, because that's where you grow and learn about yourself and learn how to be kinder. So don't be afraid of making, if you're always 100% you always say wrong things, then that's not a good average. 7 out of 10 things you say are okay. The 3 out of 10 is when you really say wrong things. And that's where you learn. And say that to your partner. You know, that you know, you say rotten things, I say rotten things. And sometimes you get wound up, you're tired. What I said earlier about your resilience. Sometimes you're so tight, like an like guitar string, you're so tight because of what you've been doing today. And a little thing your partner says, bing, really resonates because you're already tight. So learning how to just relax. Even just before you say these things to your partner, do 5 minutes of meditation, just let go. And afterwards say, I didn't want to say that to the people I love. Just coming from that stress of modern life, which makes us not resilient and we just blow up too easily. We're finished. Okay, we're over time. Those people already put their hands up, and there's one over here and one in the corner there. We have a rental?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
We don't own it.
We don't own it. Oh, I'm terribly sorry.
Okay.
One more. Okay. 2 minutes, okay. Quick.
I'll ask another two.
Okay, ask another
question.
Okay.
Can you ever be cruel to be kind?
Cruel to be kind, it never works really. Because a lot of times that, yeah, you're cruel and people don't know why you did it and then they're cruel back. So, mostly no. Be kind to be kind. Okay, you can have a quick one over there. Sometimes one of the best ways of dealing with it is to totally ignore it. Because if you get upset about it, then it reinforces it. They're offensive to try and get some reaction out of you. So sometimes, if it can be ignored, this is why do I listen to fools? To people who don't know how to speak. If you speak appropriately, kindly, then I'm going to listen to you. Otherwise, I can't tell you to shut up. I'm just going to block my ears so I don't listen. I don't look. Get your newspapers, not which put stupid people on the front cover, but good newspapers. Or good news feeds on the internet or something. There must be some ways that we don't focus on some of the inanities, offensive speech of people who just like to be heard because they're narcissists. If you don't want to feed a narcissist, just don't look at them. They're not important. That's just one idea anyway. So I know there's many people like me who do talk too much. Which is why I'm telling people that I'm starting and I'm going to be the founding member of a group of people who, you know, you have Alcoholics Anonymous for people who drink too much alcohol, Narcotics Anonymous for people who take drugs. I'm going to start the On and On Anonymous for people who, once they've got a microphone, can't stop speaking. Oh, there's books and calendars outside, apparently. So this is actually raising the funds for Anacapa, my book. So if you haven't got time to answer the questions, they're in the book. Outside, somewhere. Are they? What books have you got outside? Not my books. My narcissism is hurt. Oh, it's other books. But there's calendars of Anacapa. Promote. Look, this is one of the reasons I'm here for this visit. We got Buddhist monks, Buddhist monasteries. How many Buddhist monks have we got in England right now? How many Buddhist monasteries have we got? How many Buddhist nuns have we got fully ordained bhikkhunis in England right now?
One.
One. And she's right in front of you. Only one. That is just not on. No equity. No fairness. And quite frankly, there's things that I'm a very well-known teacher, but there's things which I cannot teach, which a nun can teach. Women have told me that. And I accept what they say. So we need, if we want to get traditional Buddhism, as you were saying over there, as in the time of the Buddha, there's great bhikkhunis, Buddhist nuns. In the time of the Buddha, yeah, you've got monks. But I want to make sure that if any of you or your children, female children, ever, probably they won't want to be, but if they want to have the chance to be the same as a Buddhist monk, male, they have the opportunity, they have the chance to ordain as a Buddhist nun with all the precepts and the training and the wisdom not taught by Buddhist monks, but taught by Buddhist women, led by them. So they take the equal stage, equal respect. Otherwise, look, this, I see many women in front of me now. Many of you have got huge potential, great possibilities. Maybe, I'm not sure, maybe too late in this life for you, too committed or too caught up. But imagine what would have happened if there was great monasteries where you could have gone for a few years or maybe your whole life with women as leaders, women as teachers, women as guides. We'd have doubled at least the wisdom available to a country like this. And it's almost like criminal. That hasn't happened yet. But we try to do our best. Venerable Chanda is, what do you call that? Endangered species. The only one in Britain. So you better look after her. So looking after her, we started a temple in Oxford. It's only a rented place. But it's a start. So please, at the right time, you can see how you can visit, how you can support. So she's not overburdened and burnt out. It's not an easy life as a monk, especially as only one of you. A lot of responsibility, a lot of organisation. If you can help there and support, you know, sometimes it's not even just a financial support, it's just showing that you care. Showing that you treat a fully ordained bhikkhuni exactly the same way as you treat a fully ordained Buddhist monk. Okay, yeah? Very quickly, I can't see you, but the light's in my eyes. Okay, please say.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, just ask. I mean, what is the argument about? Is sometimes you can basically circuit break the argument. Yeah, sometimes that's what I use jokes for. Sometimes because when people laugh, we laugh together. We share jokes. So if you do have a repertoire of funny things to say, it's one of those funny things you can tell them, is that a master's advice to the disciple. He told the disciple, never argue with an idiot. And the disciple said, that's not compassionate. And the master said, yeah, I agree with you. And I do have to stop now. So you can tell them that story, and that just stops them arguing. Okay, so thanks again for coming here today.
and I wish you all happiness and
well-being.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, we'll see you outside. And there's lots of lovely calendars that the volunteers have made. They're very beautiful. So they're for donation and for fundraising for our project. You can also find information about what we're doing and how it's going to benefit everybody. So that's going to be long page so people can come and get them. And not only women, also men. Well, we're just starting. So it's really a community effort. So however you want to be involved, see the information. And thank you very much for coming. So if you just let it out first, otherwise John tends to get bombarded with cash or
Mogash.
So
okay, just
clear.